So that's one main point in this purport. And then also, Prabhupada addresses approaching saintly persons for some material benefit. So yeah, it's true that any association with an advanced devotee is beneficial. But if we're approaching an advanced devotee for something material, please bless me so that my mother can be cured of her sickness. Please bless me so that my business can be successful. It's not bad per se. I think the example is given that if a beggar approaches a king and the king is very charitable, he has a massive kingdom, a massive treasury, and he's just ready to give. He's in a ridiculously charitable mood, and the beggar comes, please, O king, please give me a pinch of ashes. Please give me a pinch of ashes. So you could say, well, is it wrong that he asked for a pinch of ashes? Not exactly wrong, but it's just darn right foolish. It's just very, very foolish. He could practically end his suffering in that life. Just ask for, 1 million gold coins or whatever. He's done. But no, he asks the king, can you give me a pinch of ashes? So something very useless. So similarly, if we approach an advanced devotee, or if we approach the Lord here and we're praying for some material benefit, there is some benefit, but we're really missing the real wealth, because by the Lord's mercy, which comes through his devotees, our Krishna consciousness can awaken. Brahmanda Brahmite Kona Bhagyavan Jeev Guru Krishna Prasade Pai Bhakti Lata Bij. It's explained that by the mercy of Guru and Krishna, bhakti is established in the heart. And that is what makes life really successful. That's what separates our human life from any animal form in life, that we have the intelligence to discriminate and to awaken our dormant Krishna consciousness. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, in his purport to the verse, Savaipum samparodharmo yato bhakti radokshaje haitukya pratihata yayatma supraseedati. He explains what is the Lord's mercy, because it sounds very nice, mercy from the Lord. But what is that mercy that we're seeking for? He explains that really what the Lord's mercy means is that bhakti, devotional service to the Lord, is manifesting in the heart. That is the sign that we've achieved the Lord's mercy. And the way that mercy is received, it's primarily through the Lord's devotees. Although from what I understand, there are rare cases of the Lord giving direct mercy to a fallen soul. But primarily, it's the Lord's devotees who give their mercy first, and then the Lord's mercy has to follow. Just like we were studying recently in the Saturday Bhagavatam class about the four Kumaras, how they were blessed by Brahma, by Lord Brahma and Narada Muni, that you will meet the Lord, and when you meet the Lord, all of your impersonalistic conceptions, they will be smashed. And so by the mercy of Brahma and Narada Muni, the four Kumaras, it was arranged that they would go to Vaikuntha and they would meet the Lord face to face. And so from there, that's when they became from impersonalist to personalist. That's when they achieved a very, very pure attraction for the personal form of the Lord. Although that's also a very extensive story. I won't go too much farther into that. Prabhupada explains in this purport that, on another point, that nobody but a Vaishnava can become a good man. Harava bhaktasya kuto mahadgunaha. That verse from the Bhagavatam, 5th canto, that as we perform devotional service, Prabhupada would often stress, we must see divine qualities arising in our character as we perform devotional service. We must see divine qualities, genuine humility, kindness to all living entities. He would often quote a list of 26 qualities from Chaitanya Charitamrita. And so he said that only the devotees really, he's saying only the devotees actually have these qualities. And Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati Thakur was very heavy. He said that humility is a quality, this isn't verbatim, but he said basically that humility is a quality that is only found in the Vaishnava. Because real humility is identifying oneself, the soul proper, as the eternal servant of Krishna. So if someone still has a karmi mentality, and it can't be just theoretical, that if we still feel that, well, I'm not really the eternal servant of Krishna, if that's not established, then we cannot claim that we're fully humble yet. Real humility is identifying ourselves as the humble servant of Krishna. And Prabhupada went on further to describe real humility, that you will do something bold for Krishna's service. real humility, you will do something bold for Krishna's service. Like we see with Hanuman, that it was it that when he knew that Ravana was, he knew of Ravana's nefarious activities towards Sita and Ram, and so when he was captured, he burned down the city of Lanka. So the question comes, well, he's a Vaishnava, but how can you claim that he's humble? He just wrecked the whole city. No, but he is humble because he's doing it simply out of service to the Lord, not out of some desire for fame, not just out of his own personal anger. Prabhupada said that the way to utilize anger is if anyone blasphemes or offends a devotee or a devotee of the Lord or the Lord himself, then that is a bona fide situation to utilize your anger. It's good to use anger in those situations. In fact, one of the first 20 principles of sadhana bhakti is that we must not be tolerant of any offense to a devotee or to the Lord. And Prabhupada says that without following those 10 principles, one of them includes not being tolerant to the offenses. If we don't take that seriously, then we cannot even do sadhana bhakti. He said we cannot even be elevated to the platform of sadhana bhakti if we don't take this seriously. And so then the question comes, what is sadhana bhakti? It's not exactly the externals of coming to the temple or chanting japa, but really in the nectar of devotion, it's pounded heavily that sadhana bhakti means always think of Krishna, never forget him. By any means, always think of Krishna, never forget him. So there's real humility. Even Lord Chaitanya prays, Trinadapi sunichena tararapi sahishnina amanina manadena kirtaniya sadahari. By this humility, one can chant constantly. If one's able to chant constantly, that means he is actually remembering Krishna. So that shows the importance of this humility. And then another point I said that really stuck out to me in this purport was that even though Nalakuva and Manigriva were in a holy place, and one holy place sanctified by Lord Shiva, but still because their only purpose there was to gratify their senses to the extreme, they didn't get the benefit of the holy place, of the sadhu, nothing. Earlier in the fourth verse of this chapter, Prabhupada says very clearly that it was given the example of the Ganges, that not everyone who bathes in the Ganges is actually purified. That he said the mental condition is everything for going to the Holy Dham. The mental condition for why we're going is everything. And so I'm just studying now in the third canto, 20th chapter, fourth verse. Prabhupada is quoting Narottam Das Thakur saying that oftentimes it may be detrimental to the Holy to go to the Holy Dham if someone has the wrong purpose, because he may see someone in the Holy Dham with a very bad character, and so he may think, I've been to the Holy Dham, but what benefit did I get? And Narottam Das Thakur, he especially stressed that we should do Govinda Smarana. We should remember Govinda, his names, forms, pastimes, wherever we are. But Prabhupada said that, at least for those in the beginning stages of devotional service, traveling to the Holy Dham can be beneficial either way, but he stressed that the main purpose of going to a Holy Dham is that we have to seek out an advanced devotee who can really reveal the Holy Dham to us. I've heard Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur describe that actually in the Holy Dham there is a net of Maya over the Holy Dham, so that one has to be above the covering of Maya or under the shelter of one who is above that covering in order to actually derive the real transcendental benefit of residing in Sri Vrindavanar. Even this Niraman Reti Dham, it's a holy Dham. Radha, Shishu Radha, Sham Sundar, Gornita Krishna Balaram, Srila Prabhupada, so many wonderful Vaishnavas, they're here. But if we don't take advantage of the Vaishnavas, then there's one famous verse Prabhupada quote. Unfortunately, I don't know the Sanskrit. I really should know this by now. But he says that if one just goes to a holy Dham to take his bath, but not to associate with the advanced devotees there, then he is no better than a cow or an ass. Yeah. And so Prabhupada throughout his books, he's very heavy on this again and again, that we must be serious to seek out an advanced devotee. He says in that purport, a tattvavit guru. Tattvavit guru means one who knows the science of Krishna consciousness. In Chaitanya Charitamrita, I think it's Madhya Lila, 15th chapter, 108th verse. I'm not entirely sure. But he says that one who knows the science of Krishna, he's fit to become any kind of guru, Shiksha, Diksha, Vartma, Darksha, anything. If he knows the science of Krishna, that is the main qualification for being a spiritual master. And so, yes, Prabhupada, he was very heavy that we must also aim to understand the science of Krishna in order to purify our heart. And Srila Narottam Das Thakur also sings, Hari Hari Bifale Janama Ganoinu Manushya Janama Paya Radha Krishna Nabhajya Janya Sunika Sunya Vishakainu. That, oh no, I've wasted this human form of life and I've not tried to understand Radha and Krishna. Therefore, I have knowingly taken poison. Knowingly taken poison. So, Prabhupada stresses again and again that in different purports, different books, that if someone still has a material conception of life, if he's not eager to understand the science of Krishna consciousness, without understanding the Lord in full, we cannot awaken our dormant Krishna consciousness. Because even if we're thinking of Krishna, but if we think that Krishna is just some boy, if we have a material conception of Krishna, then we're not really thinking of the Krishna who resides eternally in Goloka Vrindavan, who is always surrounded by his associates, the Vrajavasis, or in Dwarka the Dwarkavasis. If we have to have the proper transcendental conception of Krishna, then our mind will become gradually more and more fixed on him. Siddhanta baliya chitte nakara alasa ihahaite krishne lage sudridhamanasa. That by conversing more and more about Krishna, by understanding how he expands through his potencies and how he acts through his potencies, then gradually our mind becomes more firm and attached to him, to the point where even in this material world, Maya cannot touch us. And the fourth chapter, 10th verse of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna explains that those who have been purified by knowledge and tapasya, penance, they've achieved this stage of transcendental love, bhav for me. And in Prabhupada's lecture on that verse, he was saying that the stage of bhava, it cannot be achieved artificially. It's not that at the time of death we go back to Godhead and then we meet Krishna and then we develop our relationship. No, we have to develop our relationship now, and then at the time of death we'll be thinking of Krishna. Then in Chaitanya Charitamrita, Madhya Lila, 20th chapter, 396th or 97th verse, Prabhupada quotes from the Ujjaval Nilamoni and states that when we become mature in devotional service, then at the time of death, then after that we will take birth either in this universe or in another universe where Krishna is having his lila, and we take birth in the womb of a gopi there. And so then from there we get to enter into Krishna's pastimes. So this stage is not achieved artificially. It has to be achieved by bhavo gyana tapasa, by cultivating knowledge of the Lord, and by penance, tapasya. But then, of course, this cultivation of knowledge of the Lord, it's not a separate, independent endeavor. In Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's commentary to the last Chatur Shloki verse, Etavade vajigyasam tatvajigya sunatmana anvayavyatirekabhyam yatsyat sarvatra sarvada. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur describes that we shouldn't exactly be dependent on reading so many books, but we should be dependent on the lotus feet of Guru. And Prabhupada also said one time that if you just I'm going to read this book on my own, then it's called Gyan. And he said that if Guru tells you to read the book, then it's bhakti. If Guru tells you to read the book, it's bhakti. So when Krishna says bahavo gyana tapasa, he means it always has to be under guidance. In fact, when Srila Rupa Goswami describes the 64 limbs of sadhana bhakti, first he says, Guru Padashrayas Dikshadi Shikshanam Vishrambhena Guru Seva. So the first one is Guru Padashrayas, taking shelter of the lotus feet of a bona fide spiritual master who knows the science of Krishna consciousness, who is Tattvavid. To take shelter of him means to be dependent on his mercy to understand who is Krishna, who are Krishna's associates. And so then that word tatvavit, whenever Prabhupada in his lectures would discuss that, oftentimes he would say, what is that tatva that the guru knows? And then he would quote, vadanti tatvavidas tatvam yajgyanam advayam brahmeti paramatmeti bhagavan iti shabdyate. The guru, he knows, and he has seen this absolute truth, which is, it's a non-dual, it's one absolute truth, but people realize it in different phases, either as Brahman, either as the all-pervading aspect of God, which is everywhere and everything, to the point where in Nectar Devotion, Prabhupada said, so the name Krishna actually means and includes everything. When you say Krishna, it actually does mean just everything. That's what Krishna means, everything. But of course, there are different varieties. And so further realization is Paramatma, that Krishna is localized in the heart of every soul or in every universe. From Paramatma, one is not at the stage of prema yet, the stage of perfection, pure love. There is a great bliss in it, but until one comes to Bhagavan realization of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Brahmano Pratishtaham, that Supreme Personality of Godhead on which Brahman itself rests. When he understands the Supreme Personality of Godhead and he has his Ishtadev, that particular form of Krishna in his heart, then he can give that form of Krishna to you. In the 10th canto, 2nd chapter, 18th verse, Prabhupada explains the meaning of that word diksha, that it means, in conjunction with the example of Vasudeva and Devaki, that when Vasudeva impregnated Devaki, it wasn't through the regular method, but it was a heart-to-heart connection. It was diksha, that he transmitted Krishna from his heart to her heart. And so Prabhupada said diksha means that the guru has Krishna in his heart, and so he can give. He knows the science of Krishna consciousness. He has his relationship with Krishna, and he can also see Krishna in the hearts of others. In relation to Shukadev Goswami, he said, "Hridayam munim anatosmi." That Shukadev Goswami, when he spoke to all the sages, especially Parikshit Maharaj, there were so many thousands of sages, and he did not have a microphone. So how did they all hear him speak the Bhagavatam? He didn't have any microphone. He didn't have anyone. He didn't have people shouting out what he was saying. Hridayam munim anatosmi. Shukadeva Goswami entered the hearts of all the sages and spoke the Bhagavatam. He wasn't trying to yell really loud so everyone could hear him. He was speaking the Bhagavatam into the heart of everyone. And even when Vyasadeva was chasing after him, when Shukadeva Goswami left home, he entered the hearts of the trees and animals and started instructing Vyasadeva, "Oi, are you my father or am I your father?" And so to enlighten Vyasadeva that this father-son relationship is really based on the bodily concept of life. So again, Prabhupada, he's always stressing again and again that... Oh yes, and so Param Anjanam in this verse, the best ointment for the eyes. So at the beginning of each class we play Oma Anatimarandasya Gyana Anjana Shalakaya. So the guru, we're always praying, the guru, he's given me the ointment by which I can cure my spiritual blindness, by which I can cure myself of this agyana, this ignorance, avidya. So this ignorance is described in five ways. One is tamas, that we forget our spiritual identity. Tamas means forgetting that we are the eternal servant of Krishna. Jivara svarupa hoy Krishnara nitya das. One type of ignorance that is necessary for us to live in this material world is forgetfulness that we are the eternal servant of Krishna. And Prabhupada explains that this arose from something called tamishra, anger, envy at the Lord. That why should he be the Supreme Lord? I want to be the Supreme Lord. I want to be an independent enjoyer. And so this material world exists for souls like me who wanted to try to basically be Krishna myself. I wanted to enjoy separately like Krishna. I wanted to be the enjoyer. And so from this anger, I had to be covered by ignorance to enjoy. If we're really conscious of how great Krishna is, of how he acts through his potencies, but of how dependent we are, of how minute our independence is, and of how loving and sweet Krishna is. If we know all these things, it's very hard to be an independent enjoyer. So Krishna being merciful to us, respecting our minute independence, which he never touches, he covers us with ignorance after ignorance. And so then after these two, there's moha. First we forget our spiritual identity, then we assume a material identity. Oh, I'm Abhimanyu. I'm a 19-year-old Jewish boy. I go to UF. I'm an American. I'm an Alachuian, whatever. All these different identities. And then from there, maha moha. That everything in relation to this body, my parents, sister, or maybe later in life, who knows, children, or cats, or dogs, or family, society, nation, all these things are mine. I'm this body. All these things in relation with me are mine. They're meant for me to enjoy. And so but then when our enjoyment spirit with these isn't satisfied, that tamisha, that frustration arises. And then ultimately that last layer of ignorance is anda tamishra, that after death there's nothing. It really comes heavily to that we're just this body, and that after death there's nothing at all. Just finish. Just like a light bulb switch off. So that is the last layer of ignorance. So when we pray Om Gyana Timirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha, when we're praying like that, my spiritual master, he has removed the darkness of ignorance from my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge. We should check that all these types of ignorance are leaving. Am I identifying myself as a servant of Krishna? Or am I identifying that I'm this body, that this house is mine, this dog is mine, this mother is mine? Am I still afraid that after the time of death, nothing is left? So we can check these things when we pray that Om Gyana Timirandasya. That my spiritual masters, they have removed all this ignorance from my eyes out of their causeless mercy by sharing transcendental knowledge with me about who I am, what is my constitutional position, who is the Lord who I am meant to serve. Yes, the spiritual master, he can see into the heart of every soul. He can see into the heart of the disciple. And he can see which form of Krishna is their Ishtadev. Because Srila Sanatana Goswami explains, we'll see later in the 14th chapter, that 14th chapter, 7th verse of this canto, that every single soul has its own unique quality that Krishna wants to relish. And because each soul has a unique quality, it will have its own unique relationship with Krishna. Each soul will have its unique relationship with Krishna. It said in the first canto, 3rd chapter, 3rd verse, that the Lord's form, it manifests by the internal potency, by Svarup Shakti, or really ultimately by Srimati Radharani, that the Lord's form manifests by the internal potency, and bhakti itself is the internal potency. When we feel that bhakti is arising in our heart, that is the internal potency. It's the mercy of the Lord in our heart. And so by this mercy of the Lord, bhakti, and then also by that eternal nature of our soul, you know, maybe one of us is a sakya, maybe we're meant to be a cowherd boy or a dwarkavasi or a mother similar to Mother Yashoda. So depending on that, then as our heart gets purified, nitya siddha krishna prema sadhya kabanoi shavanadi suddha chitte karaya udai, that as we hear about the Lord from advanced pure devotees, then naturally our dormant Krishna consciousness is awakened, and gradually that particular form of Krishna becomes revealed to us. That particular form of Krishna who we're always searching after. In the 3rd canto, 9th chapter in Brahmaji's prayers, where he addresses the Lord as the soul of all souls. Just like the soul, it's what drives the body. The body is only going as long as the soul's inside. But why is the soul still going? We know that the body goes because of the soul. But the soul goes because there's natural affection between the jiva and Krishna. Even I just found in the first canto, 5th chapter, 8th verse, that the reason the soul exists is to offer loving service to the Lord. Prabhupada put it just like that. The reason the soul exists is to offer loving service to the Lord. And so the soul is always driven by this. But at the same time, the Lord, He desired that we come by our own free will. We come by our own free will to offer our loving service. All right. Thank you. Any questions, comments, corrections? Is there a microphone or...
You mentioned the story of Megrahi, that despite the fact that he was doing these heinous things, he was actually innocent, which seems contradictory. And so maybe what kind of... I mean, obviously he would get some reaction from those things, so therefore there would be punishment, so in that sense he was not innocent. I mean, if you follow the logic.
Mm.
So perhaps there's a more logical, a transcendental logic behind this.
Yes, thank you. So yeah, Prabhupada said that Megrahi, he was sinful, but since he was ignorant, well, one is that it's not as bad, but the thing is, there is a difference between sin and offense. Sin is anything, really the root cause of all sin is forgetting Krishna. But still, sin can be an accidental something, like even like walking, stepping on ants. That is actually a sinful activity. We're not conscious of it, but sin is like that. It can be accidental activities, and there's different gradations of sin. But an offense, aparad, that's different. That's generally it's more conscious, and it's more directly opposed to the Lord. The worst aparad, of course, is Vaishnava aparad. But yes, that aparad is more conscious, whereas sin, it's not as bad. It's not as directly opposed to the Lord, as far as I understand.
Million species, so Megrahi is intervening those species to naturally transmigrate. So that's why it's sin. It's not really sin. And whatever he learned from his father. His father was a hunter. He's a hunter. So is nothing wrong as a profession as a hunter. Is nothing wrong. But Narad Muni's point was, as a hunter, you do hunting job. There is nothing wrong. But why are you causing them unnecessary suffer? That was the question. Also, Prabhupada put in the fifth canto that if somebody is aware of his action and commits, he must suffer more. And if somebody is not aware of his result, end of life, he will not suffer. Just like a lion eating an antelope doesn't mean he will go to hell. He'll never go to hell. This is his profession. So like that.
Hari Bol, very nice. And I think you're a good example for all these youngsters here. Yeah, I really appreciate this. This is a little tough question. If there is someone very, very qualified, but he's out of ISKCON line, right? But he's a very qualified acharya, so to speak. And you have many gurus in ISKCON line, but maybe they might not be so well versed in shastra, you know, in quoting verses and so on. And you have to select, you know, to one as your spiritual master. Who would you select?
Prabhupada, I remember hearing his lectures many times. He would say that just as if someone has a profession like a doctor, it's not as good to ask which college did you graduate from. It's more important to ask, did you graduate and get a degree? That is more important, Prabhupada said. And so Prabhupada said, whether it's Hinduism, Christianity, Muslimism, anything, what we're checking is the degree, love of God. And so we're very fortunate with this Krishna consciousness movement that we have Prabhupada's books that we actually know love of God, not just like, oh, what I think love means. We know that love of God means anyabhilashita shunyam jnana karma adhyanavritam anukulyana krishna anushilanam bhaktir uttama. We understand what is pure love, that it's free of any desire other than to please the Lord and the spiritual master. It's free of jnana, a separate independent desire to understand the Lord, because the devotee, he's dependent on the lotus feet of the acharyas, of his spiritual master. It's free of karma, doing activities for personal sense gratification. Jnana karma adi, it's free of things like unnecessary austerities, like unnecessary fasting or unnecessary meditation. Anavritam, it's uncovered by these things. Anukulyena krishna anushilanam, that pure bhakti is, it's favorable It's a favorable cultivation of activities for the pleasure of the Lord under the guidance of his advanced devotees. But Anushilanam Bhakti Uttama, this is first class devotion. So Prabhupada said that we're not asking which college you graduated from. I mean, even, you know, there are four Vaishnava Sampradayas. There are four bona fide Vaishnava Sampradayas. They're not, they wouldn't all be called ISKCON. Doesn't mean that bhakti is limit. We I don't know that Prabhupada ever said that bhakti is a monopoly of ISKCON. There are different sampradayas, different, they each have their own branches. So we cannot just claim the monopoly over bhakti. Even there was the issue of the Nityananda Vamsa that Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati Thakur smashed very heavily. That they were claiming that the Nityananda Vamsa, they were people who would claim that, oh, they were descendants of Lord Nityananda, and so only they could spread love of God. They claimed that we have the monopoly over bhakti, forget you all. And so Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati Thakur was so heavy against it. So we cannot claim that we have the monopoly over bhakti. Even Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, in his commentary to the very first verse of Bhagavatam, he gave five different translations and purports, entirely five different translations and purports. And his fifth one was that this Janmadyasya verse describes bhakti itself. Janmadyasya ta unvayad itaratas chartesu abhigya svarat. The word svarat means independent. Bhakti, that also applies to bhakti. She's independent. We cannot lock her down. She's very dynamic. She can spread to different movements. Basically, Prabhupada describes that when someone has a sincere desire to know the Lord sends some advanced devotee to awaken their dormant Krishna consciousness. And even in the Bhagavatam, not all the speakers are in the Brahma Sampradaya. Maitreya and Vidura. Maitreya is from the Kumara Sampradaya. He's not, forget ISKCON, he's not even in the Brahma Sampradaya. But he's a great speaker of the Bhagavatam. Maitreya Muni, he described the creation so wonderfully. And he described so many prayers. I mean, I'm still studying his teachings now. So yeah, we cannot say that only ISKCON can have gurus or that it cannot have bona fide gurus. I mean, it depends on one who knows the science of Krishna consciousness and who has received it from the Guru Parampara. Is that?
So if you feel that there is an acharya out there that's really qualified and give you or teach you the science of Krishna consciousness, are you open?
Yeah, if he can awaken my dormant love for Krishna, sure.
Hare Krishna. I don't think it's an appropriate question for the, you know, for the audience.
Okay. You want to?
I just want to confirm and follow up about the nice discussion about the distinction. I really appreciated the distinction between Murgari the hunter and Manjeeva Nala Kuvera, and then question about sin and offense and that distinction. And just to kind of confirm what was discussed, that in there, okay, clearly Murgari the hunter was torturing animals, not just killing them, so he was like very sinful. But in his relationship, when he first met Narada Muni, he had an open-minded, childlike innocence. And Narada Muni was like, no, you shouldn't torture them. He's like, well, why not? He didn't argue, he just, well, that's what I learned. So there was like a childlike innocence. Whereas with Nala Kuvera and Manigriva, they were neglectful, they were impudent, and so even though they were much more elevated in the modes than Murgari the hunter, they had a neglectful attitude towards the pure devotee Narada Muni. So that's the distinction.
Mm.
Thank you.
I can elaborate a little bit on that too. When you say give a child, like if you had an 8-year-old child and you were to give him, say, alcohol, and he would drink it trusting you, not knowing that it's really a sinful activity. So you would not, I don't think the child would incur sin from an activity of ignorance. And you know, so that goes through for the hunter. He did not know, he was in ignorance about it. So, like a child.
But if he touched fire, he suffered, but not, doesn't mean that he
Hare Krishna, Prabhu. This Megrahi topic is a hot topic. I first of all wanted to appreciate how you kept referencing verses. You knew the chapter and verse for the point you wanted to make. It was one after another, so impressive and so inspiring. And therefore, before I say what I wanted to add, I'll apologize for not knowing any chapter and verse, but I've heard a number of times sitting in such august assemblies, kind of like what your father was saying, but how I remember hearing it was that, and it might be in teachings of Lord Chaitanya, that when Narada came, by his presence, the animals were freed from their traps, and they ran away. And Megrahi was actually really angry about that, and he wanted to yell at Narada. But when he saw him, Narada's presence, as you were describing, any contact with a saintly person, and what to speak of a saintly person on the level of Narada Muni, his heart became softened, and although he wanted to yell at him, what he ended up saying with folded palms was, "My dear saint, thank you so much for coming to my place. How can I serve you? May I give you some offering? How about some skins of animals that I've killed?" You know? And then Narada Muni said, "No, but I do have one favor to ask of you." And I don't know where I read this, but I know I've heard it more than once, that when he was asking, "Please don't kill them halfway, but kill them all the way, because they suffer so much," that Megrahi was actually blessed with a vision of the kind of karma that would come to him from all the killing that he had done. He saw all these animals coming back. And so it wasn't only his innocence, it was the mercy of Narada manifesting and showing him what kind of reaction he was going to get, which of course made him extremely humble and extremely eager to take up whatever course his guru ordered him. I hope someone can find the chapter and verse.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, it is mentioned in teachings of Lord Chaitanya and then also Chaitanya Charitamrita. I didn't remember hearing about Megrahi the hunter seeing a vision of the animals coming back from him, but I do know from Bhagavatam that at the time of death, it might be from the story of King Purunjana, that at the end of his life, he saw all the animals coming back from him. So that does make sense.
In the sky.
In the sky.
Anybody killing any animal as a human, when they die, they have to answer to those souls. They are waiting. So it's not just they can just leave the world and just forget it. No, they will be forced to ask. They have to answer to all those souls that they killed. So it is in Puranjan's story.
Just a quick point. I had a discussion on the same point about 2 weeks ago, and I looked it up afterwards all the time, how Prabhupada had answered that question about innocent, to a query, innocent. And he said that the criteria for innocent is once they come in contact with the devotee. He says if they become submissive, they were innocent. If they don't become submissive, they're not innocent. Because just like we're talking about your karma, you can have good karma, bad karma, but that's not... That's just what goes on until you meet the devotee, Brahmanda Bhumite. So when you meet the devotee, that's how... Because Prabhupada was saying that they're all innocent. He's traveling all around the world, and he says mostly people are innocent. And the devotees will say they're all demons. What do you mean mostly they're innocent? And he says, well, the criteria is once you give them the information, if they change, then they were innocent. Palena Pachyate.
I guess this conversation has diverted a little bit, but if we answer to every soul that we've killed, does that include every mosquito? And what type of answering process? I mean, it's like, what's the level? Killing an animal, it's almost because of its size that there's more weight to it, but every soul, I mean, just this movement of my hand is killing so many souls.
I mean...
Something that he did, now the dog is coming by, and you're thinking, allow the dog to come inside the altar? He said, no. Anything to please the Guru Krishna, that if there is something on the way disturbing, and if they are removed, is no harm, no sin or offense or anything. Like Prabhupada stressed this point, at least I heard in MP3 again, Prabhupada said that at night when Mahaprabhu was lying down, then Govinda Das stepped over. In Vedic culture, you never step over elderly person, especially God, Supreme Lord. But he stepped over to give him massage. And whole night he is staying there after massaging. And when Mahaprabhu woke up, he said, why are you still here? You should go and rest and eat. Say, oh, for your pleasure I can come, but for my pleasure I cannot. And Prabhupada said, this is important. This attitude is important. For Guru Krishna's pleasure, if something gets killed or something, is no harm. There is no harm. It's only benefiting them. But for my pleasure, yes, I have to be responsible for that.
Yeah, I remember on one of the summer trips, we had a conversation with Jai Advaita Swami, and a similar topic came up. He said that just like when if a soldier goes to battle and he kills someone, then he's not in trouble. Rather, he may get an award if he kills a lot of people. But if he comes home and he kills just one person off duty, then he's arrested. It's counted. If he kills one person while he's off duty, it's counted. And so similarly, while we're performing devotional service and while we're acting for the pleasure of Guru and Krishna, then yeah, there's some of the animals may die. There's no sin. But as soon as we're not acting for the pleasure of Guru and Krishna, then there is sin. In fact, in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur in his commentary said that when we forget Krishna, we're actually accruing unlimited sinful activities. So yeah, when we remember Krishna, when we chant his name, so many go away. And when we forget him, so many come back. So yes, it has to be that attitude that I'm the humble servant of my spiritual master and of Krishna. We do have to maintain that attitude. Not that I was born in the movement, so I'm invincible.
This also confirmed in Bhagavad Gita, yat karosi yat asnasi yat jayosi yat asiyat, that whatever one does, let it be as an offering unto Krishna. And then he also talked about sarva dharma parichaja, that surrender unto me and I'll take away all the reactions of your sinful activities. So when one engages in devotional service, even when we eat, like we have to kill the plants and vegetables, that's what we eat. But because it's being done as an offering unto Krishna, then the reaction is not there for us. And in performing our devotional service, sometimes things happen, like what she was talking about, stepping on the ant. So one consciously doing it, like during the Bhagavatam class, the devotees here, they were trying to get his ant out because he may step under somebody's foot and get killed. So because we are conscious of it, we are trying to save it. But we won't like willfully do something. But in the course of our activities, because we are in an entangled material world here, then it consists of action and reaction. But when we engage in devotional service, then that reaction is cut. If we don't engage in devotional service, then the reaction is there.
We have time for one more.
Thanks so much for a wonderful class. And I know it's getting late, and so this conversation is not going to be able to probably be completed, so perhaps it can be continued elsewhere. But just the idea that, I understand that ISKCON doesn't have a monopoly on bhakti, but at the same time, Srila Prabhupada, he was so careful the way he set up ISKCON and the way he trained us, and the way he emphasized over and over again, to read his books and not to become distracted, and said that his books would be the law books for the next 10,000 years. I think it's just important to make that point that, ISKCON is really a special shelter, especially at this time in Kali Yuga, and that we would have to I wouldn't think that if Srila Prabhupada was here right now, that he would say, oh yes, if there's someone else outside of ISKCON who's able to, awaken your love of God, it's okay to go to that person, because it is such a big society. There is so much choice. Anyway, I just felt it was important to make that point. And if there is other discussion to be had later on, I'd be happy to be a part of that. Thank you, though, so much.
Yes, that is an important point. That sure.
It is described regarding the same point here of the point of chastity came up. It's described that like a chaste woman would have many friends, many male friends, but she wouldn't give them herself to any one of them the way she gives to her husband. That's special. So similarly, we being trained, being born into, being grown up within our ISKCON society, that we're chaste to Srila Prabhupada and Srila Prabhupada's ISKCON. So, in other words, if someone may appears to be better or better out there, then we stick with what we have. Just like with a woman, there are many other men that may be better than her husband, but she never sees that. She understands, this is my husband, and I give myself. Similarly, within our society, within we are born and raised and trained and join ISKCON, we remain loyal like that. I just want to make that point.
I mean, yeah, for sure. What Prabhupada, probably the shelter Prabhupada has given us, his books, it is undoubtedly very special. Yeah, that he's really very clearly chalked out our goal of life, the process to attain it.
Personality cannot produce another great person. That is not a proper to say that Prabhupada is greater, greatest of great, all great, and he does not produce the greatest personality. That is not proper to glorify. Prabhupada is great means he can also produce a lot of great souls, great acharya, great gurus. So we should not say that in ISKCON we don't have. It is not proper. Because Prabhupada is great. How do we know he's great? Because he produced great too. We cannot say that we are not great. So, that's my point. That if Prabhupada, to glorify Prabhupada means Prabhupada is greater than all, that means he is producing also greater. Maybe I'm not seeing it. That's my misfortune. How do I know every ISKCON devotee? Do I? So we should not say that there is no great personality in ISKCON. It's not proper. Prabhupada is great means there is many great personality in the movement. Maybe I haven't met.
Yeah, Prabhupada said in one lecture that I'll be satisfied with just one pure devotee, but I'm very fortunate because I have many sincere and pure devotees. After just 10 years of the movie going, 1975, yeah.
Prabhupada said, I was looking for one moon, but I found many moons.
Yeah.
Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Srila Bhagavatam ki jai.